This podcast is supported by Americans for Medical Progress and was founded and created through the Michael D. Hare Fellowship, awarded annually to support projects that inform and educate the public about the critical role of animal research in furthering medical progress. The fellowship honors the late Dr. Michael Hare, a renowned board-certified laboratory animal veterinarian who dedicated his career to scientific and medical advancements and who was deeply committed to animal welfare and advocacy. Hey, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Lab Rat Chat. Thank you for joining and listening to us today. We have a very special guest for you to hear today. Her name is Dr. Jody Selinsky. She's an animal welfare officer. She's joining us from halfway or almost all the way across the globe from the University of Auckland in New Zealand. So we're very excited to speak with her. Before we get into letting her introduce herself, as we always do, I first want to, again, just remind everybody to please rate and review Lab Rat Chat wherever you can, mainly Spotify, mainly iTunes. If you could just hit pause, go do that now. This podcast will be right here waiting for you when you return. We greatly appreciate it. It does help us, you know, attract more listeners, get more viewership, which then helps the longevity and helps us continue to get this podcast produced and speak with awesome people just like Dr. Selinsky, who's going to tell us all about, you know, animal research and what goes on down in New Zealand and that part of the world and how it's done. So we're excited to talk to her. And Dr. Selinsky, thank you for coordinating. I think you're waking up pretty early. I'm not exactly sure what time it is over there right now. I know you, but I know it's 1:30 currently where I am.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Jeff.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you would just, you know, first, I guess you can tell us what time it is so we know how early you had to get up. And then you could go in and just tell us a little bit about yourself, you know, where you work, what you do, and kind of how you got to where you're at in your career today and what made you so interested in kind of science and veterinary medicine and everything else.
Great. Thanks. Thanks, you guys, so much for having me on. It's 7:36 a.m. on Friday morning. Is it St. Patrick's Day? Oh, Lordy. Oh, won't be going out tonight.
Not here yet.
There's a lot of Irish people in New Zealand, so it's a good fun day here. Thanks so much again. So I am the animal welfare officer and university veterinarian at the University of Auckland. And for Americans, that is akin to an attending veterinarian, if that helps. And I've been here for about 7 years. And my journey to lab animal medicine was very circuitous. I probably have as much of a non-traditional route as you could possibly imagine. Although my parents do say that I did want to be a vet when I was younger. I know you guys like a good story. So it all started out when I was working in theater. That might be strange. So I loved performing and I was a singer and a dancer and did stage shows. And so I ended up, when I went to do my bachelor's, I did a bachelor's in theater performance. I loved performing and communication and education in general. So I kept it to a BA instead of a Bachelor of Fine Arts. I kept it to a BA so I could do a lot of psychology and communication education work as well. You know, as I went on, I did have high hopes of getting a Tony on Broadway, but I did sort of think that that was probably less of a chance and maybe I don't have the patience for that. So then I thought about being a lawyer. So I figured that's acting and I might get $400 or $500 an hour for that kind of thing. That sounded better than being a starving actor. But then I didn't want to do some of the things that I thought I might need to do, like defend people who might be people I didn't want to defend. I'm from Miami originally, and I moved from Florida to what I deem, and I'm so sorry, this might be offensive to Americans, but when people all think America's the same, so I try to say it's really not. It's sort of like lots of little different countries in one. And so then I moved over to Oregon, which I call the normal corner. So I moved over to Oregon because my uncle was there and a friend of mine also was looking for a change. I did shows and nannied and did that kind of stuff when you're in your early 20s and figured out, you know, trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I missed my horses and my cats. So I contacted the zoo to see if they took volunteers, which of course zoos have a huge volunteer program, but I didn't realize it back in the day, a couple of decades ago. Yeah, I became a volunteer at the zoo and started taking, you know, education animals out to schools and working on that side of education and comms. And got a job at the zoo in marketing and education and writing shows and doing shows for the public and PR stuff, etc. And then I sort of did the whole, maybe the science-y animal side of things is quite fun. So yeah, I started volunteering with the animal behavior studies team and in the vet hospital on my days off and started thinking maybe I could do science. Maybe I could science. So yeah, I took a chemistry course and thought if I did well, I might do a BS. And so I did. I got the highest grade in the class and finished off my Bachelor of Science to complement my Bachelor of Arts. And then thought to myself, wow, okay, I'm really interested in behavior and animals. And was I going to try and plump for a PhD or try and get into vet school, which I heard was
impossible.
The hardest professional right. school in the land. All of my family are all in human medicine. And I'm like, I'm going to try to go a step above. So yeah, I took some master's classes to test the waters there and then became a trainer at the zoo and a nurse in the vet hospital as time went on. And yeah, I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll give it a go. Maybe I'll try to get into vet school. And I did. I got in. It was pretty exciting. And I was always a zoo girl. I was like, I'm only going to vet school to be a zoo vet. And then one of my professors introduced me to wildlife work, which I loved. And I was going to do the whole traditional internship and residency and be the best that I could be until a man came into the picture. And I had volunteered with a friend of mine in the Cook Islands doing some animal work. And I met him. He was a Kiwi who's a, New Zealander living in the Cook Islands. And I thought to myself, okay, after a year of long distance relationship, do I bring a Kiwi mellow guy to the US during my internship and residency where I probably wouldn't see him for more than 13 minutes a day? Or do I chuck it in and head over to the Cook Islands? And so I said, meh, things are always there in the future. So I decided to move to the Cook Islands and hang out with him. And yeah, I did animal work over there for several years and he was the president of the SPCA. And so we kind of did that developing nation stuff where we assisted our community in, care and well-being of animals. And we got funding and we hired an animal control officer and got a pound and did a collar and tag program and all of that kind of stuff. And the first time I ever walked our dog on a lead, I thought people were going to fall over. It was so foreign to see a dog with a collar and a lead.
Right.
And it was quite interesting. And then as I went to New Zealand to do some relief work, just to have an opportunity to get off a 20-mile round island with 10,000 of your closest friends, I ended up sort of falling into this job advert and talking with the SPCA because they wanted a veterinarian and they were starting a TV show and needed a bit of gregariousness. So I said to Nick, I'm going to go to New Zealand and do this, work over there and do this TV show. Do you want to come? So we moved over to New Zealand back then and about 20 years ago. And yeah, went that for a few years. Then I actually went back and did a formal zoo and wildlife residency at Massey University in Wellington Zoo. Then I got convinced by a colleague to work in academia. Then I got inspired by a colleague in lab animal medicine at the university to give it a go over here, despite my vehement protests that it was a specialty and I couldn't possibly, and being very American. And I finally went, okay, maybe I'll give it a go. And my original mentor, the late, great Dr. John Schofield, convinced me that I could do it and told me that I would know after 1 year if it suited me. And here I am again, that 7 years later, as the attending vet at the University of Auckland, where I oversee animal care and use and do everything from strategy and policy and teaching and occasionally acting as a veterinarian.
Every now and then, huh?
Okay. Sometimes I even act as a veterinarian. Yeah. So it's been fantastic. I love this field. I wish I knew about it in vet school. I hope more people are knowing about it in vet school. I mean, I did graduate over 20 years ago, so things have changed, but it's so rewarding.
Yeah, I think in my class, we had four people, including me, that wanted to go into laboratory animal medicine. I think I'm in small animal medicine now. So
I was going to say, and then you bailed, Jeff.
I know. And then I think I know at least one other one also bailed. And I think two of them actually went on to residencies. But
I think you'll be back, though, Jeff. I think you'll be back.
Yeah.
Just a matter of time. You know, I needed to experience this side.
Yeah, Jeff had a roundabout route as well, and he didn't, like, grow
up. I was
up.
Not.
Yeah, he went back to vet school as an old man, so.
Yeah, so did you get board certified in zoo medicine, or is that, like, you did the residency in zoo medicine, or the zoo and wildlife residency, did you get boarded in that, or did you get boarded in live animal, or neither?
No, so doing my residency over here, so I have to look into it because there's a non-traditional route, but I think that there's, because we don't have, like, at Massey University, which is the only veterinary school, there is no board certified.
Okay.
And same with at the zoo I was working at. So over here, it's just kind of almost for New Zealand and Australian context. And we do have what's called the Australian New Zealand College of Veterinary Science, and they have a fellowship. It's kind of a different system. We have memberships and fellowships. So memberships are, I guess people have explained it to me almost like ABVP over in the States. You can do it as non-traditional, but you have to be examined. There's oral exams, there's written exams, and the next stage is fellowship, which is like being a specialist. So I have my memberships in avian medicine and surgery because our fabulous wildlife over here is mostly really amazing birds. So I did that. I did my memberships in avian medicine and surgery. And then again, that sort of non-traditional route. I'm definitely board eligible for lab animal medicine now. It's just thinking of if I want to take the boards.
Right.
that's something I'll grapple with, which essentially doesn't really matter unless I want to go to the States, to be fair. But yeah, we'll see. I take an exam and then I go, I'm never doing that again. And then, you know, years go by. And
that's what I was like, yeah.
I'm just not doing that.
After the NAVLE or, like, you know, the licensing exam, I was like, never again. So
never. So
yeah, that's funny.
I think that's okay. You know, I think it's absolutely okay. And you will be back. You will be back.
I feel like I'm still in it. I'm not at work, but, you know, that's why I love this podcast and being able to talk about it. So it's quite the story. I enjoy hearing about everything you've done. And it's definitely different. Not the traditional wanted to be a vet since you were 6 years old.
I don't know if we've ever had a guest that I wanted to be a vet. I did undergrad animal science. I went to vet school. Like, I feel like everyone we've talked to has had a unique story about how they ended up here. And they just keep getting more and more unique.
Maybe because we talk to more lab animal vets and vets that are doing something different than small animal. Everybody that I work with, they're all obviously small animal vets. They're all just like, ever since I was a kid, it's what I wanted to do.
I say, and I've said this, I have a goddaughter who doesn't know what the heck she wants to do. And I'm like, you know what? Just don't even worry about it. I tell people, take opportunities that come to you, volunteer, follow your passion and your gut, and you'll be okay. I mean, people might have thought I was just an absolute ninny for doing a theater degree. Like, where's that going to get you? You know, that kind of thing. And maybe it could have been, but actually it served me well for communication, getting people on site in jobs and in the community and education and giving talks at conferences and all kinds of PR stuff and situations where there's a fake it till you make it type, you know?
Every day.
Every single day. So
you said you went down there for a TV show. What happened to that TV show? Are you on it? Can we go watch you on some sort of program somewhere?
It is still on Animal Planet worldwide. I think it must be on Animal Planet Europe because occasionally I have a colleague that goes overseas and they'll say, oh, I couldn't sleep in the middle of the night. And I turned on the TV and I was trying to sleep and suddenly I heard your voice. And I was like, ah. So, yeah, I did it for a few years. And then much, much to the disappointment of my producer, I said, oh, I need to go back to my zoo and wildlife medicine roots. And she was like, no. And then they tried to get me to do another TV show. And I'm like, no, I did it for a few years. It was like 2003 to 2006. It was called Animal House. You can find stuff. Probably can find snippets online, and it is on Animal Planet Around.
Okay, yeah, I'm gonna YouTube it later, so I can go find it.
Actually, there is some sort of a snippet or something because our training specialist emailed me during Tech Week last year or the year before and said, "Can I show this to the team? I think it'll make them laugh." And I'm like, "Oh yeah, sure, go ahead."
So, right.
There must be something out there.
The different regulations and laws between, and it's kind of cool that you do know a lot of what goes on in the US, but specifically in New Zealand, because we've heard, you know, I don't know if you guys cover cephalopods or bans on animal testing, or if you can kind of talk about sort of broad picture differences that you know of between US and New Zealand for animal research.
Yeah, sure. Again, I know some about the US, but not all. So feel free to correct me, or I don't want to dabble too much in that. But I do definitely know that vertebrates are under your animal welfare in research. That's kind of where it ends. I also know that this was funny when I was over at an organization in the States and they were running a training session and they said how mice and rats are less sentient animals. And I was like, what? So we don't have a separation like that. All animals are under the Animal Welfare Act or sentient. None are less sentient. And we also do have invertebrates, not all invertebrates, obviously. But we have crabs, lobsters, crayfish, squid, and octopus under our Animal Welfare Act.
Being in Louisiana, I do have to correct the crayfish to crawfish. Just throwing it out there.
Well, you have crawdads or something like that.
Yeah, right? They do say crawdads, and there's that Netflix show, but they sell mainly crawfish down here in Louisiana.
Crawfish, yeah.
Don't they also call them crawdaddies? I've heard a guy call them crawdaddies. Now we're getting weird. I don't know.
I'm going to move away from calling anything daddy and just mute myself now.
Animal welfare to who's your daddy? Great. That's a good podcast today.
Touch it all.
We do have some of our invertebrates under our Animal Welfare Act. And we say that we don't treat them all the same because I'm pretty sure a crab doesn't want to be treated like a mouse, but we have the same care and consideration for all of the animals equally based on what their needs are and what they want.
So speaking about the like less sentient or more sentient, like we have oversight agencies like the USDA that will come in and do inspections only on the species that they cover. Do you guys have like an oversight agency that comes in and inspects everything because everything's covered equally and you have to have, you know, the same animal record keeping and things like that?
Yep, okay. Exactly. So the Ministry for Primary Industries, MPI, is part of the government and they oversee that. And our system's a little bit different. Each organization that wants to consider applications for animal research is called a code holder. We must have a code of ethical conduct related to the animals and animal research. And that's what allows us to form an animal ethics committee or IACUC in your part of the world. And so they come in on a regular basis and they audit us to make sure that we're keeping in line with our code, that what we say we were going to do is what we did. And they might stay for a couple days and visit our animal facilities and talk to the people in them and look at the animals and ask us questions. Then they will definitely come to an animal ethics committee meeting and look how the animal ethics committee functions, because that's part of it as well, how the committee functions and what they consider, how they consider. They will ask to see 10% of our approvals, to have a look through them, to look at deliberations, considerations, what they look like, et cetera. So yeah. And then we also rewrite that, the code of ethical conduct, every 5 years, and it's reviewed and looked at, and it goes back and forth sort of like an ethics application. And yeah, so that's how we go. And they do look at all animals. So it's anything under the act. It's not like, oh, we're not going to look at the crabs and we are going to look at the rabbits. So that's how we work over here.
And is a lot of it is it actually a law, or is it more just kind of like regulations and guidance, kind of like how it is here? I mean, we have the Animal Welfare Act, but that's the only kind of law that we have as far as being able to make sure animals are treated and handled in humane and proper ways. Are they laws over there, or is it the same kind of just regulation or guidance?
Oh, yes. So we have an Animal Welfare Act, but then we have Part 6 of the Animal Welfare Act, which is specific to animal research. So there is specific information about that needs to be followed.
Are there different regulations based on where your funding comes from?
Nope.
Like, okay. That probably makes it so much easier than having to, okay, yeah. Is it funded? Is it non-funded? Because we always have so many different criteria of what goes on based on all these things. And it almost sounds simpler.
Yeah. And I tell people, it's quite funny because I think that a lot of people don't know anything about this industry and laws or regulations and ethics committees and IACUCs and anybody. But I think there is sometimes a mistaken view that certainly universities and others will pass these applications through, even though they don't deserve it because of the money that they get for them. Mm-hmm. So if somebody gets a $5 million grant, we don't want to go, oh, don't want you to really, oh, okay. I tell people all the time, and I train every person that comes into this institution on the legislation and the expectations of the university and me and the Animal Ethics Committee, because I want them to very much understand that it doesn't matter if you're a full professor who's been here 20 years and you're the bestest ever in the entire world, and you just got a $40 million grant. If you put in an ethics application that we don't think is ethical, it goes bye-bye and it gets redone. So yeah, there is nothing like that here. Yep. Everybody is on their own merit. The only thing the committee gets slightly happy about is if they have been funded, then hopefully the science has gone through some peer review. But there is no prejudice of, oh, this one doesn't have funding and this one does have funding and we should consider this more. But I have heard that kind of out in the spheres.
Not even so much like consideration for approvals and stuff, but even, you know, if something goes wrong, what agency do you report a potential non-compliance to? You know, you have to look at all these different pieces instead of it just being one blanket, like everyone's the same, everybody's treated equally. Like, I don't know, it really sounds kind of nicer.
Yeah, that is simpler. I mean, don't get me wrong, I kind of think that I do wish that some of the funding bodies, we had a little bit closer link with them so that if something did go really wrong and they were unethical, that we could or should report that to them. I'll be honest, certainly in my organization, it doesn't happen. There's never even been a need to slightly do something like that. I work with excellent researchers.
I mean, I think the instances of that are slim, but it's just always one of those considerations because I work in the compliance office. And so you have to know all these little caveats and like reporting structures and things. Mm. So it, you know, I don't know, it sounds simple over there in New Zealand.
Yes. Yes. It's much simpler. Much, much simpler. Of course, we do have the same probably as everyone else where animals shouldn't be used if there's another reliable way.
Correct.
Yes.
For the replacement side of things. And obviously the 3 hours are considered quite a lot. Another difference maybe, which you guys don't really keep animal numbers, I don't believe, but kind of a difference is that in New Zealand, primarily, we do our animal use numbers every year and MPI compiles that and releases them. So you can look up what animals were used and how and all of that kind of thing. But in New Zealand, it's primarily agricultural animals that are used. I'm primarily biomedical in the University of Auckland. And some institutions are, but in New Zealand, overall, the animal use in what we call research testing and teaching, we call it RTT over here, is primarily agricultural.
And then do you all have ALAC accreditation down there? I mean, because ALAC International does go everywhere, correct? It's something you still abide by those standards for ALAC. I mean, you may not be ALAC accredited, but I guess it is something that, do you guys pay attention to their standards and that kind of sort of thing too?
We do. And we have had the most fabulous Catherine Bain down here. And she's had a walk around and we are looking into that. There is no organization that's ALAC accredited in New Zealand for a number of reasons. But we have discussed that at the University of Auckland and we would like to go down that road. And something that we've actually been doing over the last couple of years is one of the facility managers and I and a couple of others have met monthly and we start looking through regulations and documenting what we do well, what we don't do well, what we don't do at all, what we couldn't do because it's New Zealand, you know, versus the types of systems there are in other parts of the world. So we've been doing that over the last 2 or 3 years, trying to get an idea of what we need to do. So I don't think it'll be too long into the future. I think it's probably the medium term that we would consider ALAC accreditation. But we do, yes, we do try to say what's going on there and what's going on.
That'd be awesome to get ALAC accredited and to be the first ones in New Zealand to get it. So that'd be cool. We talk a lot on the show about transparency and the importance of transparency and not just, you know, science for the most part for so many years is always just, you know, don't tell anybody what you're doing, put your head in the sand, keep it a secret. But we've realized, especially over the last 10 years or so, the importance of being transparent when it comes to animal research and letting the public know, building that public trust about what we're doing and what's going on with these animals. And one thing I was reading about just a little bit beforehand was the openness agreement on animal research and teaching in New Zealand. And it seems like that was something that you guys kind of settled on or worked on or was agreed to in 2021. So I don't know if you know a whole lot about that openness agreement and could tell us a little bit about it, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. And I think that's something that, you know, Americans for Medical Progress and collaboration with other organizations are trying to get established kind of here in the U.S. as well. And so I just know what you're able to tell us about that over there and kind of maybe something we could learn from that over here in the U.S.
Well, I don't think we have enough time because that is like a baby to me. I literally, it was like birthing a baby for me. I did not birth a baby. Danielle, I know you have birthed the babies. I have not birthed the babies, but to me, this was like birthing a baby. So it was my favorite thing and I loved it so much. And I'm so glad it's here and I will love it forever. So before I was on ANSCART, which is the Australia New Zealand Council for the Care of Animals and Research and Teaching, which is the group that is in charge of that and that took that on. And I know that they had tried many times and sometimes timing is just not right, if you know what I mean. People have been talking about openness well before I came along in the industry. And I guess I'm a little bit like a pit bull. Once I get a hold of something, it's hard for me to let go. So I said, oh no, this is great. Look at this thing. This is amazing. This is, openness. This should be a thing. We should do the thing. Let's do the thing. Yeah. Everyone, of course, on ANSCART bought in and then we started pushing little, pushing more, pushing a lot. And I was the chair of the working group on behalf of ANSCART. And I was on ANSCART, which was sort of like a steering group. We went and went and pushed and pushed. And unfortunately, with that last big push was during the first year of COVID, which, you know, so although interestingly, it was beneficial in some ways, right? Animal research was at the forefront, getting a cure, getting a vaccine, getting a something. We all didn't know if we were going to die. So on one hand, it was a kind of a good thing for this, but also very tough because we were all having a tough time. We were all having a very tough time and people still are having a tough time. We're certainly not out of COVID, but we're out of those first real scary initial years. And so we had buy-in from lots of people. I pushed and pulled, mildly threatened. No, what does a friend of mine call it? Assertive mentoring. I assertively mentored some organizations, not bullied, not threatened, to sign up. It ended up quite successful. All the universities in New Zealand ended up on board and we launched in July of 2021, like you said. So the most exciting thing is that we were the first country outside of Europe to have one. And another very interesting fact about our New Zealand one is that we have 5 commitments instead of 4. So most of the countries have 4 that were based, of course, give all praise to Understanding Animal Research and the Concordat on Openness on Animal Research and Teaching, launched in 2014, that led us all. So most follow that and have 4 commitments, and we have 5. So our 5th one, and you mentioned, I think when we were off air, that you noticed in my signature that there was Maori, the Maori language in there. And so we have a big commitment to our tanga te whenua, the people of our land. And so we have a special commitment that we will engage our communications with our tanga te whenua about our use of animals in research and teaching. So that was important and special to us.
Yeah, that's cool.
So we have 5 commitments.
What's the overall sort of public perception on animal research over in New Zealand? Because in the US, I feel like everyone pretends they think it's bad. But when you get into like a one-on-one conversation with someone, they're like, oh, yeah, I'm all for it. But like, it's almost like nobody wants to talk about it openly or something. And I just, is there a different sort of sense of opinion in New Zealand about it?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. I think a survey will be coming out sooner than later. The last really robust, excellent survey that was done was about 16 years ago. And that showed quite a bit of support. It was like 68 to 72% for wow. Research, testing, and teaching. And again, I do think that that is one, because we are quite an agricultural nation. 2, remember that surveys are a bit kind of fraught with danger. It depends on how you do them, who you send them to, how you word them. And so I think it is, if you phrase it, if it's for the benefit of humans and animals and that you're minimizing the harm, and you're minimizing the use and you're telling people, you know, we're not doing this willy-nilly, that it does seem that people will support that use. I know in the US, you guys run sort of the 50-ish percent line, and that's probably common, but you've got that Pew and Gallup poll that are run every now and then. But it, again, it's not a pulse very specific to animal research. Not a whole, the whole poll isn't about animal research. It's put into other things. And again, that can influence people's responses. Questions before or put after certain questions can influence responses. And again, how you phrase them. So I think when the next survey comes out in New Zealand, which again, it's slated to, I think we'll find a bit more than the US. But again, it's hard to tell because like you said, you could talk to people one-on-one and they're like, oh yeah, we totally support it. Oh yeah, you guys have the 3 R's. Oh yeah, you guys have laws and regulations. Awesome. But if you just walked up to somebody and said, hey, do you support animal research? They're like, what are you doing? And who is it? You know, there's so many more questions. So it's a lot like that. I think there seems to have been a lot of support for our openness agreement. The signatories seem to be doing well without any blowback at all. We just had the survey report after the first year come out, which if you want, I can send you the link when it goes up there so that people can actually see the survey about who did what and how that went.
Yeah, that'd be good. So that's kind of what that does then, huh? So anybody anywhere, if they wanted to go find that information, they could go and find what New Zealand and what the universities are doing with their animals and what kind of research. Is that the information that they'd be able to find?
Absolutely. So the openness agreement and then the survey information as a report is meant to be freely available online. I mean, we don't say the University of Auckland did this and this person did this and this organization did this, but it's in there about how many organizations perform research and teaching and how many are funders and the like, and how many people did stuff on their website versus how many people did stuff with education and all of that. So yeah, that report will be available online at Anscart. So I'm happy to send you some links to that.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll put those links in with our notes so that everyone can access it. And we'll put them in our social media link page as well, so people can click on it and easily access it that way as well. I imagine, just given your great ability to communicate and just have a conversation and describe things, that when you are asked what you do for a living with a stranger or to a stranger, whether it be on an airplane, at a party, something like that, you probably don't hold back in telling them what you do.
Yeah, she doesn't strike me as someone to choose, to tiptoe around the subject.
Right. Yeah. So what's your strategy for, you know, describing what you do to somebody? And maybe, like we were saying, maybe the public perception's a little different down there, so you don't have to worry about it. But, you know, here, like we were just saying, sometimes you have to be kind of hesitant, a little worried about who you're talking to and what you're going to say, and worried about their potential, you know, negative reaction to that. So what's your advice, or how do you go about it?
Yeah, I don't really worry about much. It's like somebody's reaction is their own. You know, it's funny. I give talks about this all the time, about communication, especially in this area. So you would think that I would be able to answer this succinctly, but it kind of depends. All situations aren't the same. I'm really passionate about people being able to ask questions. So if I'm in a situation where I'm passing by someone or it's a cursory thing, I don't necessarily go into that because I won't have time to answer the questions. And then what I feel like is that person's going to be left wondering and not knowing, and then maybe finding the wrong information or not accurate information. So for me, all situations aren't the same. And I tailor my answer to my audience. I talk to children a little bit different than I do adults. And again, like I said, if I have time to chat with somebody, then I'll take it in a different direction as versus if I'm just passing them by. So essentially, if I'm at a party and someone asks what I do, I try to phrase, I don't say like, I'm the attending veterinarian or I'm the animal welfare officer, because that doesn't really mean much. So I try not to use acronyms. I try not to use phrasing from our industry. And so I say, I'm the veterinarian in charge of animal health, welfare, and research at the University of Auckland. And sometimes they say, cool or interesting. And that's pretty much the end of the conversation. And sometimes they say, oh, there's animals at the university? So it's really funny. Like, they can ask very different questions, or they say, oh, what welfare or what research do you do? So sometimes it's not about me. Sometimes it's about the research that we do. Sometimes it's about what my job is. Sometimes it's about what animals we have. And then I'm very, very honest. And as I tell everyone, you should be as honest as can be and answer their questions. And sometimes they'll ask you tough questions and have that pre-prepared. If you're going to get into it, then you want to have all of this stuff in your mind, things that you've practiced beforehand, because you don't want to get flustered at the time. And then you should also make sure to know how to get out of jail free. So make sure that if somebody is getting a bit more than you can handle, or that, you know, you're feeling a bit abused, then come up with an answer that can quickly get away. And oftentimes you can say just, hey, you know what? It seems like we're both really passionate about animal welfare. That's great. I'm going to move on and have a chat with someone else, or, you know, it's time to go pick up my kid or whatever. So something I say is also is always to be very compassionate and kind. It's really easy. I mean, we know what the inner monologue is, which all of us are thinking, but that doesn't help. So being compassionate and kind, giving them factual information, saying we don't know everything, saying things don't work all the time, saying, yeah, you know, sometimes the animals have to be euthanized, and this is why, and this is how we euthanize them. We euthanize them in the most humane manner at the time. We follow things like the AVMA euthanasia guidelines. So you want to be as honest as you can, kind as you can, because they're coming at it because they're passionate about animal welfare too. And that leaving them with that last taste that you're a kind person that loves and cares for animals is great, because even if they don't agree with you at the moment, even if they think you're an absolute nutter, oftentimes things land on people later. So if you leave them with that last bit of that person actually was really cool and calm and collected and seemed to really care, that can land on them when they get home. That can land on them a week later. That can land on them when they read an article. So I always say that's the best way to go about things. And I will tell you this 100%. I have not been abused telling people about what I do for a job now. However, I was often abused telling people what I did when I worked in a zoo, when I was a veterinarian in the zoo and wildlife industry. So believe it or not, I was more abused there than I have ever been in the lab animal industry.
I mean, I guess I could say there is a lot of opposition to zoos in general out there too. And people think you're, you know, keeping animals in enclosures that, and they should be free and in the wild and running around, living their happy lives with their other animal species out there. And there, I could see that too, I suppose. That makes sense.
And when you're a wildlife vet, same when you're a wildlife vet and there might be an animal that's stranded or in need and they think that you should do something, and you say, well, look, we don't want to interfere because of this, this, and this. Oh, you're letting that animal die and blah, blah, blah. So it doesn't matter what you do. And if you interfere, people are like, don't interfere with that animal. You know, so
can't win.
It's amazing the abuse in that industry versus this one. So yeah, look, everybody's got their issues. I mean, we know our colleagues in veterinary medicine, also in small animal medicine, my heart goes out to them. But because, you know, people aren't necessarily nice, and I hope mostly it's because they care so much that it overwhelms them and they lose that ability to be kind and instead sometimes get cruel. But in our industry, I'm very, very passionate about all of us, whether you're a cage washer, animal care, vet, nurse, whoever you are, a researcher, that everybody could feel confident and competent having just a tiny conversation with someone about openness and what you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I like how you described to have a way out of the conversation. I think that's important. We haven't really talked about that, but how do you kind of end it when you know it's not going anywhere positive? And to also do it in a way that's kind of still professional and leaves them with kind of that good vibe at the end of the conversation.
Exactly. Look, psycho, suck it is a way to end the conversation, but it's like, and you can think it, and I do often, but it's also the mini filter. I mean, I'm queen of not being able to have a filter sometimes, but in professional.
Like we were saying beforehand, we need the Lab Rat Chat After Dark edition to really get into this topic fully.
Say what we really want to say. Is there anything that you would want to say that we maybe haven't touched on, or any thoughts that you have about, you know, the laws and regulations in New Zealand that we should let our listeners know about before we wrap up this episode?
Oh, that's a good question. There's so much, there's so little. I don't know. Yes. I guess in general, with the openness thing, I really, 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 really have to impart to people that it is absolutely okay. I'm just going to say it again. It is okay to admit that we don't know everything and there are costs and limitations. We want to make sure that people know about our industry, but that it's not perfect like any. all the animals aren't, you know, running through fields of grass doing whatever they want. You know, some of them do have to live in unnatural environments, but boy, there's a whole industry that wants them to have the absolute best that they can. So even if an animal, say a sheep, is inside, we try our very best to give them food, to give them friends, to give them interaction, to give them as much as they need and as much as we can within the confines of our research. Most people don't know that there are laws that even govern us, that there's a lab animal profession and researchers and animal care staff, vets and others that love and care for these animals. So making sure that you get that across however you can is a really big deal. And we're not here to persuade people to believe us or to like animal research. Heck, none of us like animal research. But we want to be able to reassure them, because reassurance is much more powerful than persuasion. And be calm, cool, and kind. Like I said, we are all coming from a place of love for the animals, even if, you know, some of us show it in different ways. And it is possible to make a connection with people even that are initially opposed to animal research. And I do that all the time. I even work with our New Zealand Anti-Vivisection Society, and it's amazing how much common ground there is. So we shouldn't stop trying and just, you know, keep at it. We need the judicious use of animals in research and teaching still at the moment. We all long for the day, all of us together, right? All of us together, you know, do the little air quotes, whatever side you're on or walk of life you come from. We all want to see the end of animals used in research. So let's maybe try and keep that in mind and try and some way move forward together for the animals and for the people and for the amazing research outcomes.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said it better myself. I've tried many times, and so never comes out. Never comes out as good.
I get really passionate. Oh boy.
Yeah, we can definitely tell, which is awesome, which is, I mean, if you, for everyone down there that you get to train, it has to go through you, and then they can see that, and then just kind of spreads throughout the university, and all of that can breed a great, you know, program and a great culture. So it's great, everything that you're doing. We're thrilled that you were able to join us today, all the way from New Zealand. You're basically in the future right now to us. You know,
I'm totally in the future. You're Friday is awesome, by the way. It's totally awesome.
I was going to
awesome.
Ask
You'll
you how
it.
Friday is. So
yeah.
I want to know what to prepare for.
Well, definitely, it's the most amazing day. Yeah, you will have such a good time.
And it's St. Patrick's Day. I mean, so like you were saying,
bring on the green beer. No, I'm
just nice. Can't get enough of it. Okay, well, if you have anything else, do you have anything else you wanted to add? I mean, I don't think you could have wrapped it up in a more, you know, elegant manner than you did. But if there's something else, you know, now's the time. Otherwise, we would just like to thank you again for joining us. We hope everyone learned a ton. I know I did. I'm sure Danielle did.
Absolutely.
I know Danielle has kids waiting for her at school that you have to go pick up. So we do have to wrap this up at some point. We don't want them abandoned at daycare.
Hey, and more importantly, my cats are feeling neglected right now. I usually play with them in the morning. Yeah, they did not get. Yeah. Indy's very upset he didn't get to be on video, and we skipped playtime for this.
Was he trying? It's still on your head looking for
yes.
the video?
Yeah. Shoulders and head.
Yeah. Well, next time we'll have to do a video just so we can have the entertainment of your cats.
Sure. There. Oh, by the way, disclaimer, as a responsible wildlife vet, I do keep my animals inside. They do not go outside.
You don't have outdoor cats?
I do not.
Protect the bird population.
Yes, protect the environment, protect my animals.
All right. Well, again, everyone, please go rate and review the show. Dr. Selinsky, you can go rate and review the show too.
Happy to do it.
So feel free. We would appreciate it if everyone out there could do it. It does help us out. You can email us, which is another, you know, we get lots of emails and we do try to respond to all of them. So labratchat@gmail.com. If you have questions, you know, that you don't want to put, you know, in the public eye somewhere that you just have about the field, shoot us an email. We'll answer you. And other than that, Dr. Selinsky, again, thank you again so much for joining us. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for dealing with our daylight savings time and rushing on to this call sooner than we had anticipated originally.
Yeah, thank you. Yep.
Well, thank you, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure. You're wonderful. So thanks, Jeff and Danielle. And I look forward to maybe one day being on the podcast again.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'll talk to you all later.